by virtue of the Submerged Lands Act and the Statehood Act, owns submerged lands up to the 3-mile limit. Obviously, the information gained onshore in the Arctic Range, Arctic Refuge, will assist the state in deciding how to offer its offshore lands and the value of those lands. As well as the surface, the subsurface information also obviously provides the basis for decision making in managing the Arctic Range itself, Arctic Refuge itself. The subsurface information that we gather, the federal agencies and the state and the public in this process will improve our knowledge of the balance of values in the Arctic Refuge and help us decide what kind of a management regime the area should have permanently. And what I've tried to do is very briefly summarize the kind of concerns that might be the state's interests when that decision-making time comes sometime in the future after Fish and Wildlife finishes the 1002 study. Obviously, the state and its citizens are interested in the maintenance of wilderness and wildlife values in the refuge, as evinced by the Porcupine Treaty that we've been talking about, and other examples that, of the state's interest in maintaining and protecting those surface resources in the Arctic. The second major concern, obviously, is oil and gas potential and possibly production in the area. At this point, as Mr. Gilmore stated earlier, the state would receive a 90% share of any revenues generated by the congressionally approved production in the Arctic Refuge. Whether or not that formula changes, the state will have an interest in padding the Prudhoe decline at some point with production from new fields, whether or not it's in the Arctic Refuge or elsewhere, with revenues from taxes, with the economic effect of new field development, and pardon me, and that's it. However, the revenue formula could change, so I think, as Mr. Gilmore said, the Congress probably will be looking at that as well when it decides whether or not to approve production in the refuge. The current management issues in the area obviously include the Caribou Treaty, the subsurface resource evaluation on federal lands, and whether or not that program is adequate, and whether the information that's produced and presented to Congress next year will be adequate to base decisions on. A third issue is the drilling that's already occurring on some ANCSA lands within the refuge. The data produced on those wells on private from those wells on private land are not shared with the state, so we don't know really what kind of potential there is from actual drilling within the boundaries of the refuge. The last major current management issue, which there was some discussion of this morning, obviously, is the land exchange proposal that has come forward. The federal government may attempt to obtain inholdings in other refuges, including Kodiak, Yukon Flats, Canute, Nuwitna, Koyukuk, and Innoko, sometime in the future by trading out lands within the Arctic Range. The state's perspective on that so far has been that we're very interested in it because obviously we want to know what's going on in the state of Alaska, and because this could affect prospective revenues that would have come to the state, that 90% share that I was talking about. And at this point, we have said informally to the Interior Department that we want to be involved and consulted in the process of the land exchanges. We also are looking on this as possibly an opportunity to consolidate the state's inholdings in the refuges, because the state also is a landholder within some of the refuges, and this might be a good opportunity for us to participate in one of those exchange negotiations with the federal government. That would conclude my comments, and pass it on to the next person.
I think then we'll move to Roland Shanks with the Department of Fish and Game.
Well, I'm not sure there's really much I can add to what Ned said. Basically, the state is in a position of preparing to respond to the 1002 report that's brought forward by Fish and Wildlife Service. The Fish and Game Department has been very active in with the service in cooperative studies on the North Slope and in ANWR in support of the 1002 studies. I guess the only thing that I might add is that the state government is a many-faceted animal, and basically when it comes down to building a state position on the 1002 study and the where we should go with ANWR, there'll be many different opinions at the table, I'm sure, as we start through the process. And the department will be looking primarily at the role of that area as fish and wildlife habitat and fish and wildlife production. That's been our mandate, and that will probably continue to be our mandate. One thing that, in addition, that we have been doing, as Ned said, is in support of the Porcupine Caribou Treaty, working on trying to develop an international agreement dealing with the caribou of the North Slope and the future management regimes. This is also very important as far as the entire ANWR answer. I think a lot of people are watching this, and I think this may in fact be one of the more crucial national conservation issues coming up in the next year or two. I think that if we look at D2 and the final answer that came out of D2, there was three places that came out in kind of a rough cut. One was ANWR, one was Tongass, and the other was access into Gates of the Arctic area. And I think those three issues are now rising back to the surface via the 706B study and the 1002 study, and will be taking center stage once again. And I guess the one thing that I would want to leave with this group is that we need to be prepared to respond as these studies come out, and also be prepared to initiate whatever action seems to be appropriate. The state will be watching both of these reports very closely for possible congressional action or whatever may be coming down. But at this point, I guess we're in more of a process of trying to make sure that the basic information going into the reports is the best information that we can possibly have, and watching to see how that information is used and what kind of analysis it goes through, and what directions are drawn from that from those reports.
I think that Roland did hit on a couple of points there, and that is that this will be a crucial conservation issue coming up, and we do have some concerns about it. And I think that Bob Adler would like to address some of the public review opportunities or non-opportunities, as it may be. Bob?
Thanks, Mike. As Mike indicated, my topic is supposed to be public participation opportunities in the 1002 process. That in itself is a contradiction in terms. I could deal with the entire subject exhaustively in a single word, none. The report will be prepared entirely behind closed doors. Not only will you not have any opportunity to comment on a draft 1002 report, you will not see a draft 1002 report. And in fact, the department's current position is that you will not see a final 1002 report. They will submit the report to Congress, and Congress will decide whether or not we are blessed with any or all of the information in the report. As Ned indicated at the beginning, they have memoranda of understandings regarding data sharing. So the state knows what's going on, and we know that the oil companies know what's going on. You are essentially the only entity that does not know what's going on. I'd like to address their reasons for not providing an opportunity for public comment, and I'll use as the best source of information Bob Gilmore's letter to me on the subject. He first cites the Fish and Wildlife Service's regulations on confidentiality of data. Some of the information that will go into the Interior Department's decision is confidential and proprietary data. And as the argument goes, some of the data is confidential, so they're not telling us anything, and they don't want to know our opinions on any of the issues in this study. And I'll quote his letter. "It is our opinion that this requirement precludes meaningful public review of non-proprietary portions of the report. Therefore, we do not feel it would be productive or appropriate to solicit public comments during preparation of the report." Well, I guess the message that we want to give to the Fish and Wildlife Service and to the Secretary of Interior is that this is a highly public issue. This issue generated a phenomenal amount of public interest during the ANILCA debates. Since ANILCA, it has maintained a tremendous amount of public interest during the 1002 study process. And I think that the participation in this room today is testimony to the fact that it will maintain an extremely high level of public interest until Congress designates the coastal plain as a unit of the wilderness system. Having virtually exhausted the topic of public participation opportunities in the 1002 program, I'd like to turn to the subject of public participation opportunities in the Tshekpuk Lake special area. Tshekpuk involves a BLM decision regarding whether or not to allow oil and gas leasing in the special area, or whether or not to maintain the more protective management regime for those critical habitat areas. The decision necessarily involves confidential proprietary data regarding the oil and gas reserves in the area. Now, does that sound familiar to anyone? To be fair about it, there are some differences between the two. But essentially, we're talking about the same type of study and the same type of analysis. Now, BLM held public meetings in which they informed the public what they were doing and how they were going to do it. BLM produced two public reports, a minerals assessment and a habitat assessment, and then they produced a draft decision document. And you know what? They even gave it to the public, and they allowed us to comment on it. They recognized that the decisions are not merely technical issues. The decisions involve highly public value judgments in which you have a right to tell your government what it is that you feel ought to happen on these highly important public lands. I don't really have a good explanation for why BLM was able to involve us in the process and Fish and Wildlife Service wasn't. But I think essentially the answer is, where there's a will, there's a way. This is a relatively negative topic to be talking about, and I apologize for that. So I'd like to end on two, if not optimistic, at least hopeful notes. One is that we have filed a lawsuit on behalf of a coalition of environmental groups in an effort to bring this issue out into the public light where it belongs. The second is more in the nature of a silver lining. I think everyone in this room ought to ask themselves, why is it that the Interior Department is going to such great lengths to keep us in the dark in this issue? And I don't think the answer is that they're rotten people and they just get kicks out of this. I think that they know that if properly armed, the people in this room have it within their power to stop oil and gas development on the coastal plain. Thank you.
To underscore Bob's comments, I think that we, as well as anyone, have an interest in seeing that the best information goes into this report so that Congress has the best information on which to base their decision. And Mr. Gilmore today solicited the help of everybody in this room in credible input into the process, and we would like to have that opportunity, but it's difficult when we have problems like Bob has been discussing. Amy Skillbred from Defenders of Wildlife would like to talk a little bit about how some of these outside negotiations are affecting or may affect the 1002 report. Amy?
Today we've touched upon the land exchange issue several times with references mainly to the mechanics of such an exchange, appraisals, and things like that. But so far, it seems we've overlooked a vital step that precedes that discussion. And that step is that the Fish and Wildlife Service has yet to make a public recommendation that the coastal plain be opened for oil and gas. And Congress, more importantly, has yet to have taken any such action to open the coastal plain to oil and gas. Yet the Fish and Wildlife Service, as was noted earlier, is devoting both funds and personnel towards examining closer such a land exchange, which is based on an assumption that the coastal plain will be opened up for oil and gas development. And there are a couple of problems with that. It's more than a year before, well, it's less now, than almost a year before the 1002 report is due to Congress, and yet work on the land exchange has been going on for, as Bob Gilmore mentioned, before he came up to Alaska. This work on the land exchange undermines a five-year process, and that process is the 1002 report. When the Fish and Wildlife Service goes ahead with examining an option, and only examining one option that we know of at this point, which is based on the assumption that there will be oil and gas development, then we're led to believe that the Fish and Wildlife Service must be assuming that the coastal plain will be open to oil and gas, and if not, a whole range of options should be looked at, not just specifically this one. The problem nationally is it has a real effect on the objectivity of the 1002 report and the recommendations that will be going to Congress. There's also been mentioned already at this point that it's compromised the objectivity of the 1002 report. And I tend to believe that that is so and that there is a problem with that. And there's no reason at this time to be examining that particular option, which is trading out the subsurface area of the coastal plain that might involve oil and gas development. And so those are some of the national concerns with what's happening. Even though the 1002 report may come forward and may have be complete on both the mineral assessment and the Fish and Wildlife Service assessment, it's difficult to leave out the fact that the Fish and Wildlife Service has gone ahead with looking at a proposal based on oil and gas leasing. So that's just one concern at this point.
What we'd like to do now is open it up for a few questions. We do want to kind of move it along and get this over as close to 3 as possible, because we do have a couple of very important workshops to go get this afternoon. But we would like to take some questions. Mr. Gilmore would be a good place to start.
Yeah. You could also try the Secretary of Interior himself, as well as your representatives in Congress. They might have some ideas about it.
Any other questions? If not, then I think we'll move on to the next workshop, which is a discussion of impacts of oil and gas development on the North Slope. And that one will begin, I guess, in about 5 minutes. We'll have a 5-minute break and then continue.
If they know,
what?
If they know, don't make sure that we don't find it.
Right.
Luckily, they were here today. So.
cross-section of interest and experience working with oil development and the possible effects or the actual effects of development on fish and wildlife resources. The four panelists are Ken Whitten, who's a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who's worked primarily with caribou of the Central Arctic herd in relationship to oil field development and the haul road and oil pipeline transportation corridor. Steve Murphy, who's with Alaska Biological Research and has worked with caribou and bird studies primarily related to oil field development. And Larry Dietrich, who's with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and has been involved primarily with oil spill and drill mud disposal. And Eric Fullman, who's a research associate with the Institute of Arctic Biology at the university and has had experience primarily with carnivores in relationship to oil and gas exploration and development activities. As you probably know, oil was first discovered in the Prudhoe Bay area in 1968, and it's been 17 years since that occurred. There was some exploration before that on the North Slope, and during this time that has elapsed, there's been a lot of experience gained from observing the actual impacts of these development activities on fish and wildlife resources. It certainly is important for us now with proposed oil and gas exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to draw on the knowledge that's available and to use this knowledge to make decisions, to make ourselves heard with regard to whether a development could take place without seriously impacting the various fish and wildlife species that are involved, but also should Congress authorize development to be in a position to draw on the experience that is available to develop procedures to minimize the impacts of those developments. So what I plan to do this afternoon is I've asked each of the panelists to keep their initial presentations fairly brief. And then after their presentations, then we should have an opportunity for interaction between the panelists and to respond to questions and have discussion with the audience. So I'd like to ask Ken Whitten to lead off.
You can go up on the stage.
Sure. Yeah, maybe I'll just go.
You won't have a light unless you turn
it on. I don't have any slides. Well, I'll be talking about the impacts of petroleum development that's occurred so far on caribou. Prior to the actual development at Prudhoe Bay, little or nothing was known about caribou distribution in that area of the North Slope. It was assumed that caribou in that area belonged to either or the Western Arctic herd or the porcupine herd, and that it was essentially an overlap zone between these two large herds. And it was also expected that any effects of petroleum development would be primarily on seasonal migrations, possible disruption or even total blockage of these movements. Alaska Department of Fish and Game initiated caribou studies in the Prudhoe Bay North Slope area in 1974. And at that time, the haul road was already under construction. There was quite a bit of development at Prudhoe Bay, and we were faced with a situation in which we were unable to actually gather baseline data on what the normal situation, so to speak, was before this development actually started. And I guess the first thing we discovered was that we weren't working with the porcupine herd or the Western Arctic herd, that instead there was, at that time, a fairly small resident group of caribou which spent the entire year on the North Slope, say from the crest of the Brooks Range up to Prudhoe Bay. And Prudhoe Bay and the Hall Road Pipeline or TAPS Corridor essentially bisected this range from north to south. In order to determine what the effects of all the ongoing and future development would be, we decided to look at caribou along the pipeline corridor and in the oil field and compare the numbers and distribution of caribou there with that of caribou in the surrounding area. We did this basically by driving up and down the road, counting and classifying all the caribou we saw, and then comparing these results with aerial surveys of the surrounding area, basically that from the Colville River on the west to the Canning River and Camden Bay area on the east, and from the crest of the Brooks Range to the Arctic Ocean. Additionally, we used quite a few radio and also visual collars on caribou to basically supplement data that we got from our other surveys. And then a little bit later in 1977, we began surveys of calving grounds. The 77 was pretty much a preliminary survey. In 1978, we went into it in a much bigger way. And then in 1978, we also began looking at the Kuparuk oil field, which is immediately east of the Prudhoe Bay oil field. And at that time, very little development had occurred in Kuparuk, although again, there was already a road in place and some construction pads when we were started our work. To briefly summarize the results of all of these studies, perhaps the first major finding, other than that we were working with a different caribou herd, was that cows, and especially those with young calves, were avoiding the development in construction areas. And we determined this basically because we always saw a lower proportion or percentage of calves in caribou along the TAPS corridor and in the oil field than we did in the surrounding area. And much of the time, this difference was very great. There were about 1/20th to 1/10th as many calves along the road system as there were in the surrounding area. As this study continued, and for 1 year only, actually in 1978, we expanded our surveys to the entire road system at Prudhoe Bay because our normal transect route ran right through the middle of it, and we were afraid that we might be biasing the results somewhat by looking at the very center of the oil field instead of its periphery. And what we found there was that there were still fewer calves in and around the oil field area than there were in other areas along the coast. There we found about 1/3 as many calves near the oil field as we did in the surrounding areas. We also noticed that calving occurred along the coast, both sides of Prudhoe Bay, but there appeared to be very few calves born within the Prudhoe Bay oil field. Prudhoe Bay area turns out to have the lowest densities of calving anywhere between the Colville River and the Canning River, which are the coastal area, which is the primary calving grounds of the Central Arctic herd. And this is due probably to some extent just to the habitat there. It's fairly poorly drained. It's probably not as good having calving habitat as the areas to either side. However, calving does occur in the same sort of poorly drained habitats immediately south of the oil field. We feel there's no escaping the fact that calving probably did occur there in the past, and it's been displaced by the level of activity that we now have. There has also been some more localized displacement of calving along the spine road through the Kuparuk oil field. This showed up early, before there was a pipeline along the road, and even in years when there wasn't traffic. Here I'm talking of just no calving occurring within a fairly short distance, up to about 4 kilometers, or say a little over 2 miles. Either side of that road. And then more recently, we've looked at calving distribution around the Milne Point Road, which is over again in that Kuparuk oil field area, but it's a road that runs north to the coast from the main Kuparik Road. And there again, one major difference this time, we had a lot of pre-construction data there, and it's pretty definite that again this sort of local displacement of calving has occurred along the Milne Point Road. The use of the greater Kuparik oil field area, though, as a calving area, and this area has, during the entire period we've been working up there, has been a highly concentrated calving area, and that use has been very tenacious. Caribou are still able to get into that area, even though they now have to cross roads and pipelines along the Kuparik Spine Road and also on the road up to the new docking facility at Aliktok Point. Although, again, within that calving area, there's one other road, the Milne Point Road, which is avoided. There have been, in addition to this avoidance phenomenon, some effects on local movements. Central Arctic herd seasonal migrations, if you want to call it that, are basically adrift from the foothills of the Brooks Range north towards the coast. Now that parallels the TAP system. There are also east-west movements along the coast, primarily during July, and that seem to be in response to mosquitoes. What we now see is a general movement eastward along the coast during periods of high insect activity, often followed by a fairly rapid movement back westward along the coast. And this apparently occurred in the past with the entire Central Arctic herd acting as a unit. What we now see is the herd split into two halves, doing basically the same thing either side of Prudhoe Bay, unable to cross through it either from the east or the west. So the oil field, which is a very large, busy industrial complex at Prudhoe Bay, seems to totally disrupt these east-west movements along the coast. Now, interchange in the Central Arctic herd between these two halves does occur, though, at other times of the year in the area south of Prudhoe Bay, where there's simply one road and a pipeline to cross. The overall effects of all of this disturbance and displacement and whatnot are somewhat difficult to assess, and I think they have to be taken in a larger context of the caribou population there. The Central Arctic herd has grown from about 5,000 to probably nearly 15,000 at the present time, in spite of this displacement and disruption of their activities. It should be pointed out, however, though, that even now the Central Arctic herd is still at relatively low density relative to the total habitat it uses. And on its calving grounds, for instance, there are only about 1/12 to 1/14 as many caribou on the 1/12 to 1/14 the density of caribou on the Central Arctic herd calving grounds as there are on the Porcupine herd or Western Arctic herd calving grounds. So it's quite obvious that there are plenty of alternative areas or other habitats available to this herd. The fact that the Central Arctic herd has increased during this period of disturbance does not mean that caribou can withstand any level of disturbance. I think it's pretty clear that some of the activities up there have affected caribou. Finally, I'll just briefly go over in very general terms, some of the mitigation procedures that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has recommended or routinely recommends regarding caribou. First, in the exploration stage of any development, we suggest that work be done on a seasonal basis so as not to conflict with the presence of caribou in the area. This generally means suggesting that work be done in the winter or in late summer and fall, and that especially around calving areas that work not be done during the active calving period or during the insect period when you have these large groups moving in unison along the coast. And we have also recommended that for the most part, actual leasing be at least delayed in calving grounds until further studies can be done. However, the department is not categorically against leasing in calving grounds, and the state has leased some areas on the active caribou calving grounds. During the construction phase, once land has been leased and development is going on, we recommend again that the work be done seasonally so as not to conflict with the actual presence of caribou in the area. We recommend that facilities be consolidated as much as possible, and we recommend that planning of these areas be coordinated. This is something that's proven really difficult for numerous economic reasons and things that have to do just with the way the oil industry operates. We're seldom able to see a long-term plan of what developments are likely to be in an area. It makes it difficult for us to plan for caribou and other wildlife. During the operational phase, then, of an actual working oil field, our recommendations tend to be such things as limiting traffic as much as possible. A lot of this avoidance and disturbance seems to be a reaction to actual traffic activity rather than just to the presence of the structures per se. And in general, during all phases of development regarding aircraft, we usually recommend that some sort of a minimum ceiling be maintained, like no flights below 5,000 feet, or excuse me, 1,000 feet in elevation. This is something, too, that's fairly difficult to enforce and to work with in North Slope areas anyway, where commonly the cloud ceiling is lower than that, and most flights then have to occur below your established ceiling. And in general, it has turned out that active harassment of animals by aircraft, which was to some extent a problem in the early days of the oil industry, really no longer is. And it's not something we worry about a great deal anymore. A final area, I guess, of mitigation has to do with controlling access, especially for hunting. When you put the first roads and airports into a new area, you create access that wasn't there before. And we've had to address this problem. And in the Prudhoe Bay Hall Road area, of course, it was first done simply by banning hunting. But as more and more areas are developed, and especially as developments come closer to areas where there are villages and where there is a tradition of use of game animals in the area, we have to look towards different ways of controlling access while still allowing that traditional or subsistence use to occur. That's about all I have to say now.
Thank you, Ken. Steve Murphy now give us a rundown on birds and a few other things.
Thank you, Dave. As most of you are aware, the Arctic Coastal Plain is considered to be of continental importance to migratory bird populations. From mid-May through September, over 70 species use the coastal plain for nesting, rearing of young, molting, and fall staging. Many of these species breed exclusively in the Arctic and migrate as far south as Patagonia and New Zealand, so it may be more appropriate to say that the Arctic ecosystem is of hemispherical or worldwide importance to a number of populations and in several instances for entire species. We've got a few slides. I'll quickly run through some of the birds that we see in the Arctic. Is there someone on the lights? Well, I think you can see these well enough. No? Well? Shorebirds have probably received more attention in oil field studies than any other species group thus far. A lot of concerns over displacement of shorebirds from development areas and loss of habitat. This is a lesser golden plover, and there are over 20 species of shorebirds that breed on the Arctic coastal plain regularly. Other members of the same order, excuse me, include Arctic terns, several gull species, three species of jaegers, and other predatory birds. More recently, the waterfowl have gained more widespread attention from agencies, and also they're obviously of economic and political importance because of exploitation by hunters in the lower 48 and the fact that these are a common resource with several other nations. These are snow geese that are of importance because there is only one breeding colony in all of Alaska. The other colonies are in Canada and Siberia. These birds breed on Howe Island, which is just off the mouth of the Saginaw-Bertok River and in close proximity to the ongoing Endicott development. And these birds were banded, have been banded over the last 5 years in an effort to study the population dynamics, and in the past year, a disturbance study specifically designed to assess the effects of the Endicott development has been initiated. Other waterfowl species commonly breeding in the coastal plain include brant, Canada geese, bright-fronted geese. In addition, there's tundra swans and several species of ducks. This is a female spectacle eider on a nest, and good nesting habitat is really what is attracts birds to the North Slope. Abundant wetlands and high productivity during summer result in high nutrient content plants and abundant invertebrate populations. Some of the major concerns regarding the impacts of oil development on migratory birds includes direct habitat loss due to placement of gravel in oil field structures, if changes in hydrology resulting in impoundments, which you can see in the bottom right of this particular picture, pollution from reserve pits leaking into tundra habitats, and dust fallout from roads, which occurs on the primarily in the downwind side, and the effect can extend several hundred meters from the road itself. It's also a concern regarding activity and disturbance itself, noise levels from activity, and as Ken mentioned, most of our studies have indicated that for both caribou and for birds, that it's the noise and the visual stimulus that may be more important than just static structures in the oil field. The concern with disturbance in migratory birds is that there could be lower breeding productivity, there could be energetic consequences due to changes in behavior result in less time feeding, and there's also concern for increase in predator populations. Arctic foxes and glaucous gulls in particular have been shown to take quite a bit of advantage of the abundant garbage and whatnot associated with oil camps, and increased predator populations. Preliminary results from some of our studies indicate that these predators can have devastating effects on breeding birds, and other researchers studying seabirds have also documented that loris gulls are quite capable of wreaking havoc with other bird populations breeding in the same areas. This past year, we began a multi-year study of the effects of the Lisburn oil development on four species of geese and tundra swans. The Lisburn development is right in the heart of Prudhoe Bay, so it was hardly a pristine area before the study was initiated. But the concern was over what the additional impacts were due to the development of this area. We used three methods of assessing disturbance. We were concerned on the effects on distribution and abundance of birds in the oil field. We were concerned with breeding densities and productivity. And we are concerned with changes in behavior and resulting energetic consequences and perhaps some more subtle problems. As I said, this is a first year of a multi-year study, and our conclusions are somewhat preliminary. However, we found that